As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
The president meeting with Jean-Claude Juncker, the European Union's president today, and saying the EU should drop all tariffs, barriers and subsidies, with the bloc's trade chiefs set to present him with proposals in that direction in a crunch meeting at the White House later today. And we're joined by a Morgan Stanley legend now, Stephen Roach, Yale University professor, joins us in New York. Good morning, professor.
Wait a minute. Richard Berner was a legend.
I hired Richard Berner.
There you
Richard
go.
Richard Berner was a legend.
So what does that make Stephen
him,
Roach?
Okay?
You?
I'm the father of a legend.
Okay, there we go. Godly.
There you go. You've been slapped down this morning. Professor, what's the minimum condition of success for a meeting like this today with the President of the United States and the European Union President meeting together?
There's not much, Jonathan. The bar is pretty low. You know, in the last 24 hours, the President has said tariffs are great, and then he said he wants to propose to eliminate all tariffs. So if they're so great, why does he want to eliminate them? They're a negotiating ploy. He's the master of the art of the deal. Right now, the art of the deal is giving us retaliation that requires subsidies by the U.S. Congress to deal with the retaliation being directed at U.S. farmers. That doesn't sound like such a great deal to me, but, you know, well, it remains to be seen where we're headed here, but for a global, interconnected world, competing not by countries but by through supply chains and the distribution of value added to multiple platforms around the world, this is a confusing, perplexing, challenging time with a lot of potential collateral damage along the way.
So we have this situation at the moment with tariffs on automobiles, and light trucks coming from Europe into the United States face a huge tariff. Then there's just sort of the basic light autos that we're used to talking about, where the Europeans slap on a much bigger tariff than the United States slaps on. Can we get something done where we remove those barriers to entry? We remove those tariffs on automobiles and light trucks?
You know, anything is possible, but, you know, is this the way to get that done? Is the way to reduce tariffs to threaten to raise them much higher than they have been and to disrupt the supply chains, which is the essence of the production platform for this key industry? So, you know, anything is possible, but I wouldn't bet that this is the right way to get there.
Do you just assume a GDP markdown? I mean, within all the fancy microeconomics, Paul Krugman's been great about showing the different dynamics here and the wedges and the, you know, the geometry of tariffs and taxes. The answer is GDP goes south, right?
Yeah, well, there's no question that in my mind that the global trade, which has gone you know, from 20 to 32, 33% of world GDP over the last 15 to 20 years has been an engine of growth for developing and developed economies alike. Global trade has been sort of flat since the crisis as a share of world GDP. And so that's made it challenging to get world GDP back to its earlier pre-crisis growth rate. And if global trade really starts to unwind, then the headwinds become far more severe and the GDP impacts will become more acute, as you allude to.
Dr. Roach, I know you're huge out on Twitter. We've got to respond. Have you respond, rather, to a presidential tweet this 5 minutes ago? Every time I see a weak politician asking to stop trade talks or the use of tariffs to counter unfair tariffs, I wonder what can they be thinking, question mark. Are we just going to continue and let our farmers and country get ripped off? Question mark. Lost $817 billion on trade last year. No weakness! Exclamation point.
Well, you know, I'm a broken record on this, Tom. The president plucks out trade as if it occurs in a vacuum, as if it's a result of the way other countries treat us poorly. He doesn't get the fact that trade is the mirror image of our need for surplus savings from abroad that requires us to run balance of payments and multilateral trade deficits last year with 102 countries. That connection has never been made in the president's mind or in the mind of his advisors, which is even more shocking because presumably he hires reasonably proficient policy advisors on the economic and international finance front. Either they're afraid to talk to them or they don't get it either, which is or both.
Very good. Stephen Roach, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it with Yale University. Not enough time today.
Stephen Aaron's joining us now. Bloomberg News Banks reporter joins us from Frankfurt. Stephen, here's the number. The weakest second quarter in fixed income trading since the global financial crisis. The five largest U.S. investment banks saw total debt trading revenue rise by 6.7% over the same time span. When does this stop, Steve?
Well, if you believe the CEO, it should stop in the next quarter. He said he's confident, very confident, in fact, that revenue in fixed income trading will now begin to rise. Admittedly, it's actually a good comparative for Deutsche Bank because fixed income trading was really weak last year in the final two quarters of 2017. So he's got a bit of a comparative advantage there. But of course, a lot of it depends on where the cut. The cuts are taking place that they are executing in the bank right now. So I think we'll need to see and wait for the next results.
What is the catalyst to drag us out of what has been a vicious cycle over the last several years, a self-fulfilling vicious cycle where Deutsche Bank have to cut, then revenue falls, they have to cut some more? Are we really breaking out of that, Steve?
Deutsche Bank certainly hopes, and the CEO, of course, most of all, hopes they can break out of the cycle. And yes, if Christian Sewing actually pulls off the feat of an increase in fixed income trading next quarter and maybe the next quarter after that, that could certainly be some sort of catalyst. And of course, if he reaches the financial targets he set, for example, cutting or keeping adjusted costs below 23 billion euros this year and reaching a return on tangible equity of over 4% next year, that would certainly be progress as well.
One of the bright spots today, quite clearly, was the advisory business doing quite well. What did you think of that, Steve?
They've been telling us for a long time that the advisory business is actually not doing so badly, and they always say it's a long pipeline. You know, I mean, when you prepare a deal, a lot of work goes into that. It's a relationship business, and sometimes the revenue doesn't show up in the income statement until maybe a year or even 2 years later. So it's good to see, obviously, but it's actually the fruit of labor from maybe a year or two ago, and now they're cutting corporate finance in the U.S. and Asia especially. So we'll have to see how that affects the pipeline now, and that won't happen. That won't be visible until maybe next year.
I mean, part of the reason they keep people, particularly key employees, is stock. Price to book on J.P. Morgan is 1.7. Price to book on Deutsche Bank is 0.3. I mean, the disparity in valuation is extraordinary. Is this guy able to retain that top 10%? I'm going to call it 8,000 key employees.
Ironically, the price of the book actually helps in a weird way. Many people at Deutsche Bank are extremely unhappy about the share price for understandable reasons because, you know, their pay packages depend on them. But since they're hired now and the price is so low, their pay packages, you know, their share options are basically worthless. So many are sticking around and hoping the share price will re-rate at some
point. Hope they get a pop. Yeah.
So, you know, in a weird way, again, it helps. But, yeah, people are extremely unhappy about
right.
it. And if they have a chance to go somewhere else and trade in their share options right. for better ones in a different bank, I'm pretty sure many people right. think about that.
Steve, quickly here, from your vantage point, balance how London and New York matter to Deutsche Bank Germany. Is it all about London? Is New York an afterthought? Or do they have an equal weight? Or is there some nuance there I don't see?
I mean, New York is extremely important. London is still a bit closer, and many of the executives tend to be in London more frequently. Garth Ritchie, who's a really important head of the investment bank, lives in London. So it's hard to say, obviously, soft factors and so on. It's hard to compare. I do think they're both really important, but the cuts, I think there are more cuts currently taking place in the U.S. So my sense is there's a bit of a shift away from the U.S., but New York will remain a very important place for Deutsche Bank.
Steve, thank you for the briefing. Learned a lot there. Steve Ahrens in Frankfurt with wisdom on Deutsche Bank. Eileen Burge with us out of London. She knows American technology and, of course, has brought that over to great acclaim in the United Kingdom. Eileen, it brings back all the emotion in all the past and present and even future of technology. Why are we still so riveted by space as a last frontier?
That's a great question. You're always throwing me these curveballs. I love it. I think it is just this sort of uncharted territory because so few people have tried to tackle it, and because of the capital expenditure required in order to try and address it. It's just been out of the reach of traditional innovators or obviously any kind of startups because of what you actually need to put together in order to
right.
get there.
I mean, within this is government trying to do its thing, and certainly they're assisting here. But the John Farrow's really smart partition is in the Business Week cover. This seems to be relatively easy. And the technology process over to traditional manufacturing processes is still steeped in the old, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's much as you said right before you kind of came over to me, it is about the number of parts, to kind of boil it down that way. And it is, you know, trying to get a sort of a new factory producing 300 cars a day, for example, has so much at risk and so many potential points of failure that I think that's doing things at scale is what always sort of stymies even the best entrepreneurs.
I'm just really enjoying Tom walking us through the launch. Where are we at the moment, Tom?
Second stage out. It's a bright red cone, and they're going to go out. NASA showing some animation, but we're at the second stage, which, John, goes down to really the technology here of why the U.S. did so better than the Soviets. Eileen, you know this from your engineering background. It's just about basic chemistry, basic physics, basic metals. These beasts that Mr. Musk is putting up in the air, they're way more sophisticated than what they dealt with a Saturn V launcher, aren't they?
No, absolutely. And I think you're also seeing people like Jeff Bezos doing similar work with rockets, right? And they're starting to now compete with one another on ego for that. But the technology has
right.
come around a long way. I think the sort of underlying physics hasn't changed, to your point earlier, right? They have to think about reentry. They have to think about what happens in the upper atmosphere. But the methodologies and the manufacturing or fabrication that they can use to put together and assemble the components has come a long way.
Well, Eileen, this is no longer just about really rich men trying to get into space. This is about trying to create a business. What is the business that SpaceX is ultimately meant to be, and where's the competition coming from?
Yeah, I think actually the competition, one of the reasons it was probably easier for Elon Musk is because it was such an open field. When the government, and I think when sort of you saw defense spending come down for space, and most of the commercial application then moved to satellites and communication technology, that's when he saw an opportunity to kind of go in there. fortunately, he is heavily subsidized by the government still in the Defense Department. But I think the commercial opportunity is absolutely trying to figure out who wants to have access to being able to launch and deploy more sort of communication-based satellites for GPS or any other types of communication for private use.
Eileen Burbidge, thank you so much for a briefing. Great to bring her in with the technology side of all this.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
John Farrow and John Norman.
John Norman, JP Morgan head across asset fundamental strategy, joining us now. John, do we have a currency war brewing?
I don't think that's the main issue. I think we definitely have a trade war, which is intensifying. That has some currency consequences, but the main focus is really trade.
When the president pushes back against a stronger dollar, what is that?
I think it's a reflection of his lack of understanding of the linkages amongst his policies. It's very difficult to have tax cuts, which are boosting growth, and have tariff policies which are pushing down EM growth and not get a stronger dollar. So it's not obvious to me how he's going to square the circle. If he wants a strong growth through tax cuts, he also wants this very punitive tariff policy, but he also wants a weaker currency.
John, are we anywhere near inflection points in selected pairs? Like if I say yen 111.05 or euro 116.91, are they in the vicinity of JP Morgan important points?
I think you're closer to an inflection point, or I think you're actually tracing an inflection point in the euro. I'm not sure we're tracing one in the yen yet. I think for the euro, a precondition for the euro stabilizing and maybe edging higher into year end was that the data improve in Europe, and that's happening. And the reason that's important is because it will reignite the debate about when the ECB should hike for the first time next year. The yen, I feel like, is still going to weaken somewhat because we do have a Fed which is pretty minded to hike in September and keep going after that. So I think if you had to choose, you know, one of these to be bottoming versus the dollar, it's the euro you choose before the yen.
John, I've got to do a surveillance correction, John Farrow. I said the late, great Al Hunt. I was thinking late because he used to come in late but be the first one in the office in Washington.
Reports of Al's Hunt.
I did not even
Al's
do that.
Demise were greatly exaggerated.
Not for a moment did I actually think that's what you meant.
I noticed it, and good old Marty Schenker said, Tom, you've got to do a surveillance.
Someone reached out to
correction.
You wondering whether...
Yes, Al has messaged us.
Al messages Tom and says, I'm still here.
I was talking about late into the office, kind of, that got lost in surveillance translation.
You're going to have to pick this up while I sit here
and laugh. It says dinner at the Palm Restaurant. Thank you, Retta. John, why don't you go save us with John Norman?
John Tucker or me?
After that one, it's pretty much all downhill.
There's three Johns around a table. John Norman, let's get you back into the conversation and let's talk about China. What is your read on what is happening with the Chinese currency? Is this a Chinese set of authorities that are just accepting it, tolerating a weaker currency? Are they trying to engineer something? What's happening, John?
I think what they're trying to do is stabilize the economy, which was slowing, and they're doing that through monetary easing. And if you do that at a time when the Fed is tightening, you're more than likely to get a weaker currency. So even though the weaker currency is not the first order objective, it's a consequence of their monetary policy decisions. So I think this is a pretty ordinary move. I think the tough call is deciding how much weakness they're willing to tolerate as they ease monetary policy, because they're much more minded to tolerate very modest weakness, 5-6% per annum, versus a number of other emerging markets, which seem to be much more comfortable with 10-15% moves. So I think this is going to be kind of a low single digit move for the year, and you've had most of it already. But if they keep easing monetary policy and the Fed keeps tightening, you know, your bias is that the renminbi is going to edge lower.
John, so far this hasn't been that disruptive for global markets relative to what we saw in the summer of 15 and early 2016. Why not? Why is this different? And do you expect it to stay this way?
I think some of the differences is that the economy overall is in a firmer position in China. There are newer growth sectors that have been offsetting an investment slowdown. And I think there also has been a recognition that China has the foreign exchange reserves to control the speed at which the currency declines. So these to me are reasons why you can have a low volatility move down in the Chinese currency going forward rather than the sort of higher vol, more disruptive, contagious type move that we had in 2015.
John, how's the EM doing? If I look at ADXY, the Pacific Rim Index, ex-Japan, if I look at your JP Morgan spot index of EM and all, how's the EM faring right now?
It's fairly mixed. I think there's clearly a divide opening up between the Asian currencies, many of which are making new all-time lows every week, and other currencies, particularly Latin America, which are more stable, and this simply reflects different country-specific drivers. Mexico is looking a little more stable politically. That's why the currency is firming. Asia is clearly in the line of fire of the Trump administration. So I think if you look at broad indices, it can somewhat mask the underlying stories that are a little more interesting. There's a whole lot of country differentiation in play
but
here.
This is really important, John. I agree with you where you say Asia's in the line of fire. But my news flow tells me Europe's also in the line of fire. Is Europe the new Asia in terms of trade upset?
I don't think quite yet, but more in terms of magnitude than in terms of focus. It's clear the Trump administration has labeled Europe a foe, but it's not suggesting that it's going to pursue a scale of tariffs on the order of what it's pursuing with China. So maybe it's just early days and Trump hasn't recognized all the things he could do with respect to Europe yet. But it looks like China is a primary enemy and the main focus, and Europe is a slight sideshow. But you know, there are no guarantees that Europe can't sort of leapfrog into the spotlight in the next couple of months.
John Norman, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate that right now. Pim Fox and Tom Keene with you this morning. We're having a spirited conversation with Sri Kumar as we look at the American economy. Sri, I'm putting out on Twitter, you'll see it first on Bloomberg Radio, the separate lines of service sector inflation, which every single listener knows is substantial, think 3.1%, and it's essentially been there forever. A lot of inflation every year in service sector. And then goods deflation, which has been pretty moldy going back, you know, good 15 years, but with a new leg up right now, just below a 0% statistic, negative 0.2%. Sri, with all that's going on, are we going to finally see goods inflation, particularly because of tariffs/taxes?
Yeah, that is the danger, I think, eventually to both inflation and to the bond yields, Tom. It may not happen within the next 6 months because the global uncertainty is more likely to affect total demand and then slow the pace of economic growth. But if the tariffs persist into 2019, then the higher costs get passed on at the wholesale and at the retail level. It passes on in the form of higher inflation, and then you have also the bond yields going up. That is then you have the true risk in 2019 of stagflation, similar to what you and I remember from 1973-74. You have a severe contraction in the economy as well as prices going up. Then it was because of a surge in global oil prices. And this time it may be an artificial increase in prices coming out of the trade sanctions. So what you say, Tom, is a real danger in terms of goods inflation for 2019, but I see the next few months as being relatively benign on that framework.
We can break out our whip inflation now pins.
Yeah, I still have them somewhere in the drawer at home. And you know, Sri, you know, I'm glad you used that term. Remember, you know, casting your mind back into history. And I'm wondering if we could just digress for just a second. And, you know, you used to work at the Trust Company of the West. You went to Columbia University as well as Delhi University. And now you've got your own firm. And I'm wondering if you could just offer some insight or detail as to what it was like to make that switch to running your own shop and what you can offer to people who may be thinking of doing the same thing in their own specific discipline.
Thank you, Pim. I'm happy to do that. The first thing I think that helps is to have a little bit of experience behind you so that you do not want to start out very fresh. I did try some 35 years ago to start my own consulting. That was on Latin American debt in the early 80s. The first year and a half was tough going. Beyond that, once people found out that this was a new area, that the debt crisis was going to continue, then the clientele very quickly developed. The second time around has been a lot easier. It has been easier because another 35 years have passed by. So the advice that I would give is, first of all, make sure, especially if you are younger than me, to have enough of a bank balance to hold you through for a year and a half to 2 years, even if you were to go easy on your spending. Second, keep your Rolodex open, keep in terms of talking to different people in the same area. And third, I would say stay very focused. Rather than say, I'm going to be all things to all possible clients, decide where your strengths are, focus on it, make sure that there is going to be enough demand for those services, and stay focused in that area. Those would be, Pim, very much three or four pieces of advice that I would pass on.
Very useful. I want to pick up on one thing you'd said, which is a new area. At the time, it was Latin American debt. Would cryptocurrencies be a new area? Should people be looking for that new area now?
I think there is a significant difference. When in the early 80s, when the debt crisis took place in Mexico, passing on to other countries, you knew that these countries eventually were going to come back to health, but you knew the crisis was going to be for a long time. I wouldn't put cryptocurrencies on the same plane, Pim. The reason is, I think it is more comparable to the Dutch tulip mania of 1637, that you just bid up the price substantially until eventually the whole thing just drops out.
Yeah.
If that's the case, you may have a future in looking at specific countries, because as my old Citibank late chairman Walter Wriston used to say, countries don't go bankrupt. But that's not true of a cryptocurrency. And that's where this job could come to an abrupt end if cryptocurrency alone turns out to be the focus of the new consultant.
Kamal, you mentioned 1637. Let's drive forward all of 50 years to 1680. And I use that really one of the essays of the year, Catherine Rempel in the Washington Post, doing a nice clinic on mercantilism. Is that really all we're talking about, Kamal? Is the president's nostalgia for a zero-sum mathematics, a non-marginalia within economics, where we just bombarded ourselves back to a discourse from pre-revolutionary America?
That's a good comparison, Tom, because again, when you go back to mercantilism, it was always a case of beggar thy neighbor policy, because trade was seen as a zero-sum game. Your trade surplus is my loss, so I have to have a trade surplus and inflict a deficit on your country. That seems to be, again, the very same principle that's being done. Trade deficit is seen immediately as having been cheated out by the trade partners. That is not going to work. Mercantilism simply didn't work because it led to too many trade conflicts. Mercantilism was again tried, Tom, going even future into the future from 1680. It was tried in 1930s. The Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of June 1930 increased tariffs in the United States. The objective was a good one, to try to protect American farmers. But what it turned out to do was to cause a retaliation by the trade partners, and very soon there was no victor. And so my fear here is, unless we change the attitude, if we continue with the mercantilist policies currently, there will be no victors, and particularly the global recession that people fear may become a reality.
But Sri, you said earlier that the U.S. economy is basically self-contained.
The U.S. economy is self-contained, but what happened? But still, you have a significant chunk of large companies, Pim, S&P 500 companies. You're talking about 45 to 50% of earnings coming from abroad. That has a hit. So what happens now is that even though exports are a small part of the overall economy, for some corporations, they are a big part of earnings. So eventually, it then feeds down in terms of reduced employment, reduced hiring, and then it shows up on in terms of the stock market behavior, and then there is a fallout on the overall economy. Mm. So you don't have it immediately as an export GDP ratio measurement, Pim, but you have it when you look at the secondary and tertiary effects of the changes.
Sri, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for your work with us here at Bloomberg Surveillance. Greatly appreciated. Sri Kumar on the American economy. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.